This is the City of Sydney's history program. The project is the Horses in Sydney Oral History Project. The interviewee today is Shauna Wilson. The date is the 6th of September 2007. It's taking place in her home in Bellevue Hill, and the interviewer is Margot Beasley. So Shauna, a little while ago you were telling me about when you were a little girl in Melbourne and how you first got interested in horses.
From the earliest recollection is all about horses for me. So everything.
What?
When did you see horses? I think from the very first moment that I could focus, or the very first time I saw a horse, that's it. It's all it became for me. Every day, every thought, every moment was about horses.
Were any horses around when you were growing up?
No. Only the milkman. The milkman delivered the milk. And I think I actually thought I was a horse. I did. I know I did. I used to think I was a horse. I imagined all the time I was a horse.
Did you ever have any contact with the milkman's horse?
Oh, I used to just creep out at 3 o'clock in the morning in my underwear and hide behind the front fence and stare at it. I was just amazed. The majesty, the beauty, you know, everything about them. I know I have a photo of myself as a child. My two brothers are standing behind me and I'm probably four, and there's a horse leaning over a country fence and I'm feeding it, and they're standing back thinking, oh yeah, if it doesn't bite her hand off, we might pat it, you know. And that, I couldn't have cared less if it did, you know. There's nothing would have kept me away from them. I was completely obsessed.
And so did you learn to ride as a girl?
When I was about 10, my mother packed me off to something called Ponyland in Christmas Hills, and I would stay there for a week in a bunk room, and I would learn how to ride and brush them and play with them, and that was just heaven. Just absolutely loved it. So I think I went there two or three times between the ages of about 10 and 12. And after that, an older cousin used to take me on weekends to a riding school in the Dandenongs. And nobody really went to this riding school except for us for some reason. And I became very friendly with the man that owned it. His name was Hans Elbers, and he was also had probably one of, at that time, the largest collection of carriages and sulkies and buggies and harness. And he came from Holland, and his father owned a livery stable there, and he brought a lot of it out with him. He came to Australia when he was about 18. And so he taught me a lot about harness, and I got to hang on to the horses when he did weddings and film work and things. And I just ended up spending all my time there when I could, if I could go there in the school holidays, and just brush all the horses and clean all the gear. And I didn't care. I just loved it.
So did you have a horse of your own?
I had a particular horse at his place that was like mine, but I didn't actually own it. When I was about 13, I met a very eccentric guy. His name was Carl Tippett. He's since passed away, and he was about 4 or 5 years older than me, and he was extremely eccentric, and he just wanted to be transported in a time machine to, you know, perhaps 200 years prior. He collected everything old. He collected penny farthings and old bikes, and he restored them. And so he came upon an old four-wheel sulky, which he restored, and then he wanted a horse to pull it, of course, naturally, and he wanted to go around Kew in Melbourne with his bowler hat and, you know, pretend he lived in another time. So I happened to be the only kid at Kew High that knew anything about harness, so I was brought along to harness up this old pacer that he'd purchased, and off we went trotting around the streets of Kew. I actually wasn't that confident, but I just pretended I was, and off we went, you know, galloping up grass verges and things like that and having a great time. And after about 6 months, he got a little bit bored with it all, and the horse was in the backyard going a bit stir crazy, so he gave me this horse, and his name was Casey, and he gave it to me on the proviso that I never sell him. So I didn't, and he ended up dying of natural causes when he was about 28.
Where did you keep him?
I just dragged him from pillar to post with me. In Kew there was a horse paddock, so I had him there, and we used to ride up and down that F3, I think it is, the freeway that sort of goes from inner Melbourne out to Doncaster. That was being constructed at that time, so there's a big grass strip up the middle, and we just rode everywhere we needed to go via that freeway off to all the parks and pony club and things like that, and all around Kew. And you know, I got my horse. I mean, I'd wanted a horse and I got it, and I just came home one day and said, I've got a horse and you can't stop me.
And how did the parents react to that?
Well, they kind of went, oh, I don't think we can. And I just got a paper round. I got up at 5 o'clock in the mornings, and I got my did my papers and got sort of $7 or $8 a week, and I paid for the adjustment, and you know, just managed. I didn't have a saddle for quite a while, and you know, eventually my parents weren't the least bit wealthy, and you know, I just worked. I always had a job then. From then on, I had a job after school to pay for the horse.
So that's Melbourne, but you came to Sydney.
I came to Sydney when I was 19, and after about a year, I got the horse shipped up. And when
so
I was
Casey in... came with you.
Oh yeah, uh-huh. Oh yeah. Oh no, I don't abandon my animals. And when I was in the Rocks one day, not long after I arrived, I saw a hansom cab trot past, and I thought, well, 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 what's this? I've got to get into this. And so I wandered up and had a chat to them, and told them, you know, what I did and what I could do, and they said, yeah, pop along to this address and we'll have a look at you, you know.
About what year would this have been?
Early 80s. I moved to Sydney in 81. Something like that. Mm-hmm. So I met the two characters that started the Hansom Cab Company, and that was... pretty much they took me at my word, popped me on a hansom cab, put me in a set of tails and a top hat, and off I went into the city.
What did the hansom cabs do?
Basically, they were a taxi service. So you negotiated a fee to go from A to B, or we took people on a circuit of the Rocks for around about $15, which took about 15 minutes. So part of the job was to convince people to take a ride. I mean, that was actually quite hard. You could stand there some days or some nights and take two fares for the whole day. But I was really good at getting people to go for a ride, so I usually made lots of money.
So did you make the money for yourself, or like were you paid on commission? Or
no, we were paid an hourly rate, and I think that's pretty much it. I can't. There may have been a little incentive, and then that was it. So if it was a quiet night, it was pretty hard because they still had to pay you an hourly rate.
Hmm. So where were the horses more or less parked if you were waiting to get a few customers?
Well, initially they used to bring them in for the weekends, and then they...
They were stabled somewhere
outside
Sydney. Yeah,
they were somewhere outside of Sydney. But then they actually got a premises at 1 Bank Street, Piermont, which probably doesn't exist anymore because it's all, you know, that Anzac Bridge has probably demolished it. But it was kind of not far from the fish markets, and it was the most unsuitable place for stabling horses. It was basically a slab of concrete that used to look over Blackwattle Bay, and it had a bit of a cyclone fence around it. So these horses, I mean, they would go to Homebush on a Friday where the markets were, where they sold livestock, and they would pick up old trotters and pacers that were going through the markets, and basically those horses were destined for the butcher. So they would pick them up and they would give them a bit of a tryout, and if they didn't work out after a couple of weeks, they'd go back to Homebush, and the horses would cost anything from maybe $150 to $300. I mean, it's not a lot of money. And then they basically spent their days staring at the water and, you know, eating a bit of hay and chaff and whatever they got. And standing on concrete. It wasn't great. They were fed as well as they could be fed. I mean, they did a lot of kilometres. They basically worked hard. All the time people commented about how skinny the horses were, but really they were no skinnier than a racehorse. You know, they were horses that worked. They weren't fat, shiny, sleek show ponies, you know.
Mm.
So they were fed. The was very conscientious of doing the right thing by the horses and feeding them properly, and she knew a lot about equine care. So, you know, they really weren't mistreated that way. Sometimes they didn't have 2 cents to rub together, so it was a bit hard to find the money to buy the feed, but pretty much they were always fed. Like, they would go without.
So about how many cabs would there have been?
There were 4 cabs.
And how long, do you know how long they'd started prior to your coming to Sydney?
Possibly only a year, maybe less than a year.
And each cab had one horse?
Mm. Yeah, just based on the London Hansom cab. So the driver sits right at the back in a little jockey seat. It's got a little trap door where you can look down into where the passengers sit. They're sitting on a bench and they've got like little French doors in front of them. And they look directly at the horse's butt and the horse trots along. It's great for the driver. You get the absolute best view from up there. You can easily see how to negotiate things and turn and twist. And, you know, I was forever just like going up the left lane and overtaking all the traffic and moving in. And, you know, I was pretty much a shocker for that because I knew that people would always give way to the horse. I had a couple of little scrapes, but no major accidents.
What do you mean by scrapes?
Oh, you know, sometimes like the wheel has a pretty big centre hub that sticks out about 4 or 5 inches. And if you didn't get that right, you could leave a nice big scrape up the side of a car.
You'd be popular.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any irate drivers coming after you?
No, I don't recall any irate drivers. Basically, when you're down at the Rocks on a Friday and Saturday night, you've got a lot of drunks to contend with. And that's, you know, I was okay with the drunks, but when they started to hit the horse or do anything like that, then that's when I saw red and, you know, I just went berserk. I cleaned up a few people down there. They didn't realise. I mean, they just don't realise, you know, how angry I could get at them for, you know, like they'd come and start whacking the horse around, you know, real idiots, real. And usually their mates would drag them off because, you know, it would just be one idiot.
What did you do to them?
Often you'd be trotting along and someone would run out into the middle of the road and try and scare the horse or do something like that. Well, we had very long lunge whips on the back with us. So you just got them. You just got them with the whip. Just, you know, and they didn't come back.
They wouldn't come around for a second go.
No, they didn't. No.
So there were never any consequences about that?
No, I always did pretty well. Yeah, I always got rid of the drunks pretty quick.
And what about the horses themselves? Did you have particular favourites?
The ones that I can remember really well, particularly Frank. There was Frank, there was Joe, there was Gus. Now, those three horses lasted the longest of all of them. I think I can remember a Bill. But particularly Frank, he was a horse that had a head like a kerosene tin with ears, and he had legs that were like the worst legs you've ever seen on a horse. I mean, you just wouldn't go near. They were always swollen, but he was never lame. I mean, he just kept plodding along. He had terrible boxy feet, really straight pastons, and you just wouldn't give him tuppence. But this horse just plodded on. You know, Frank was exactly what you needed for the Hansom Cab Company. He was totally unfazed by anything. He was really terrific. In fact, most of the time he trotted around, he was asleep. We were pretty sure of that.
Was he one of those horses who knows where to go?
I mean, they all knew where to go. They all knew exactly what they were doing and where to go. But, you know, there was this situation once where we got a new driver and they weren't terribly good at training the drivers. There's no occupational health and safety or any of that. And they just basically popped him on, took him around the block a couple of times and said, yeah, you'll be fine. And at this point, we got this chap along who was a little bit la-di-da. He said he used to play polo. And I thought, why would a guy who plays polo want to drive hansom cabs around Sydney? I thought, this is very strange. So I was working on the street. I wasn't driving. I was spruiking. And I said to him, I can't remember his name, but I said, look, you just got to watch out. When you come up Alfred Street in Circular Quay and you do that right turn into George, just in front of what was the Regent Hotel, I said, there's a really big medium strip, concrete medium strip in the middle of the road. Now, Frank is lazy. Frank loves to cut And if he cuts it, the wheel goes over the medium strip and the whole carriage lurches off to one side, and it's really, you know, quite dangerous. So just be really careful. So I told him this, and he went, started off on the little journey where you head north going up George Street, and you end up coming down, you go under the Harbour Bridge, and you come up to that Alfred Street intersection, you know, what, Pitt Street. And he basically must have forgotten. He was standing up on the back.
Is that a no-no?
It's not a no-no, but it is pretty wobbly up there. So you got to, you know, it's better to sit, but if you want to stand, you've got to be really sure-footed. So he was standing up on the back, and he didn't hold on to his left rein as he turned right. So Frank just naturally cut the corner. And the hansom cab wheel rocketed over this medium strip, and that was it. The guy just went off like a javelin, just spearheaded into the ground. I didn't quite see that because I'm standing in front of the Orient Hotel. But I do see Frank come cantering up George Street, and there's no driver on the back. And I thought, oh, I know exactly what's happened. So I ran out into the middle of George Street, and I thought, right, basketball stance, get into my basketball defense stance. I'm not going to let this horse get past me. And he came cantering right up to me, and he got within about 4 or 5 metres of me, and he just popped on the brakes, skidded to a halt, and just sort of walked up and stopped about a foot away from me, as if to say, you know, like, you could just see it. You know, he just thought it was hysterical. And I said to the people, are you okay? And they said, yeah, that was great fun.
Oh, the passengers were still in.
The passengers were in the hansom. Oh, that was great fun. Yeah. Oh, the driver fell off back there. So by the time I got someone to hold Frank and I ran down to the Regent, there was the driver being packed off into an ambulance. You know, he seriously cracked his head, and we never saw him again.
Surprise, surprise.
Mm.
What about other stories like that? I think you had a few. Well, like, there were horses with particular quirks and so on, I think, and horses that...
Oh, some horses would take off before you'd climbed up. So, like, that happened to me once in George Street in front of the Hoyt Cinema, and I'd got some people...
This is down in... heading down towards Broadway.
Heading down towards the Haymarket, down that hill.
Yeah.
And I had the horse there, and usually I'd hold onto the reins, so they're very long reins, and I'd hold onto the reins and stand onto the footpath. But after a while, you knew the horse wasn't going to move, so you just had the reins tied up there. And so I'd popped the people into the cab, and I was just about to climb up, and the horse went, right, let's go. And I swear I was dangling from the back of that hansom cab and sort of clamouring up into the seat, and I just got up there in time before he was in full trot down the hill of George Street. Things like that were pretty regular. You really had to be careful. The wheels fell off fairly often going up and down Mary Ann Street in Ultimo.
Oh, it's very steep, isn't it?
Horrible hill, and for some reason, you know, the wheels would fall off. That was always unpleasant.
Especially for the customers, I suppose.
Well, they didn't often work. Luckily, not always customers coming in and out of town, but... You know, you'd usually come straight off, but the horse would stop eventually.
So how far afield would you actually go in the
Sometimes up to King's Cross to drop people. We tried to stay in the inner city. I remember we did a horrendous wedding once that was out in the middle of... I don't know, we just went on for hours. Can't remember. That was just really bad. It was hours of driving and trotting.
And what, just too much for you?
Yeah, like I pretty much would just stick to a 10-kilometre radius of Sydney. Yeah, that would be it.
Mm. So did you do other functions quite a bit, like weddings?
The odd thing, yeah. Not too many things. But, yeah. Going back to when we used to purchase horses, it was always a bit of hit and miss.
Were you involved in purchasing the horses?
I'd sometimes go along. It wasn't my choice to buy them, but, you know, it was always fun to go to the markets and a bit sad, actually.
Mm.
Especially, you'd see mares and foals. They'd get... The butchers had a big, big long stick, maybe, you know, 4 metre long stick with a big, big wad of fabric tied on the end, which was dipped in blue paint. And if the horse was deemed to go to the butcher, they'd just get stamped with a big swash of blue paint on their butt or somewhere on their body. I've still got that memory of seeing a mare and a foal getting the big stamp, and I was just thinking, oh, you know, I wish I could do something about it, but no.
Mm.
So, yeah.
So you did do, I'm sorry, you did do other functions as well as like weddings and other sorts
we did
of
open the police station in the Rocks. It didn't last that long. They had it on the corner of Argyll Street and George Street. So it got moved, I noticed, years later, but that was the opening. We opened that particular police station. I mean, one time I used to be friendly with the Mounties and the Wateries.
So the Mounted Police.
We'd always have a good chat to the Mounties, and they were friends, and sometimes we'd socialise with them, and they patrolled the Rocks on the busy nights. So, you know, that was good. We had someone to sort of talk to. They were good guys. And the Wateries were good, and I used to give the Wateries a lift home sometimes.
Where to?
Oh, well, from up in the Rocks, I'd drop them down to where the Waterfront Police had their where the, is that where
also now
Bush is staying. The Intercontinental. I mean, great great site for a police station. And I remember I was incredibly cheeky then, and I remember saying to them, would it be all right if you know, I went for a bit of a ride on a boat one time, and they were very keen that I should come out for a ride on the boat. I said, it'd be all right if I bring a few friends. So late one night, I careered down there with about 20 friends, and they were fantastic. And they took us out for a boat ride, and we went all the way out to the Heads and had a really good look at Sydney Harbour, saw the dolphins. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And what about sort of wild times with the horses and the hansom cabs? I think some of your fellow drivers were a little bit naughty sometimes.
People got very bored and very cold, so they'd often have a bit too much to drink. And some of the younger guys were into drugs. I think they used to drop acid and drive, you know, pretty strange stuff.
Did it ever have any bearing on the way that they drove?
Yes.
What would happen?
Look, I don't think they had any accidents, but basically, you know, it was very easy to let the horses canter home, which is a no-no in harness. You really should stick to trotting. It's only for the movies.
Right, so cantering is faster than trotting.
Oh, yeah.
And you're basically letting the horse have its head.
Yeah, you know, it's just too unpredictable. You shouldn't do it, certainly in the city. You should just stay at a slow space. But, you know, the horses were keen to get home, so, and, you know, it might be 12:30 at night, so not a lot of traffic. But, you know, a lot of crazy stuff like that happened. Mm-hmm. There was always something stupid going on. Because we used to go to the markets and buy lots of horses, we just got into the habit of naming them like cyclones. So, you know, just run through the alphabet. And I remember this particular time we bought a horse and we called him Hector. And he was massive. I mean, really humongous and with a huge barrel. And got him on the Friday, and sort of Saturday morning, thought he wasn't looking too good, so she'd give him some antibiotics. And Sunday, he was dead. Got in there Sunday, keeled over. So that was a bit of a problem, because at this point we had stables in Glebe. They'd quite close to Wentworth Park, there was one block of single garages that were part of the Housing Commission, but they not all used. So she rented maybe about 12 or 15 of these garages, and she converted them into stables and an office. So Hector was in this garage, which had a stable front on it. And because he was such a huge horse, we couldn't actually get him out.
When he was dead?
No. Hmm. No, he wouldn't fit. We couldn't fit him through, apart from, you know, completely dismantling the front of the stable, which they really didn't want to do. Then there was also a problem, because they had to figure out what they were going to do with him. And there was a lion safari just west in Sydney somewhere, but they didn't want him because he'd had antibiotics. And we were really struggling. The zoo didn't want him either because he had antibiotics. So we were trying to find a way to get rid of him. And the vet science department at Sydney University said, well, if you can bring him here, you can put him in the incinerator. So we thought, okay. Now, you know, money's not lying around, so there's not, you know, we can't hire a crane or get a special truck or do any of those things. So basically they had an old Valiant station wagon and a chainsaw. So they decided to chop him up and put him in the station wagon. And I said, look, I'm really sorry, but I really can't be part of this. It's just too gory of me. So I busied myself in the office, and two or three of them chopped him up, and I'd look out the window and see bits of horse going past into this Valiant, and then they'd drive him off to the university. But they're pretty twisted people, so they sort of made sure...
Now, so these are the people who are fellow drivers.
Yeah,
and workers,
drivers.
Not
and
the owners of the company.
Yeah, the owners, yeah, I mean the dealer. Yeah. So they basically arranged Hector in the back of the Valiant station wagon so that his head and ears were sort of sticking at the window and his feet were kind of there. And, you know, they thought it was very amusing to drive him off and have little kids in the car next door going, Mummy, Mummy, there's a horse in that car and stuff like that, you know. But then halfway through this procedure, the chainsaw ran out of oil. And because I was the only one that wasn't completely splattered in blood and guts, they said, could you go and get some oil? Well, next door, right next door to this compound was the police garages where they serviced the police cars. So I wandered in there with this chainsaw behind my back and I said, hi guys, can I just get some oil for my chainsaw, please? And they were, yeah, sure, bring it over here, no problem. And brought it over, and then there was just deadly silence, and they just tipped the little bit of oil into the chainsaw, and I didn't say anything. I thought, well, I'm not saying anything if they're not saying anything. And then, you know, did that, and I said, gee, thanks a lot, and off I went, and that was that.
The whole chainsaw presumably being covered in
absolutely
blood.
Dripping in guts and blood. Yeah, yeah, it was just like, you know, if you slathered mincemeat all over a chainsaw and sort of added extra blood for good measure, that's what it looked like.
But nobody ever asked any questions.
I think it was just silence. And then I sort of headed off and they finished chopping up Hector and putting him in the car. I think they had to make about three trips.
Poor old Hector.
Yeah, so...
So how long did you work for the Hansom Cab Company then?
On and off for about 4 years. It was a part-time job and I did other things as well. But it was just, you know, that little bit of extra cash to do. And, you know, I had three or four part-time jobs. So I just worked around the clock. So it was fun.
So after you finished your time with them, did you have any more contact with horses in Sydney?
I've always had a horse, at least one. So I have kept horses in the showgrounds from the early 80s, before it was renovated and when it was part of the actual agricultural show. And it was a pretty pretty ordinary facility. And then recently in 2000 I kept a horse there when it had been renovated and it was very nice, much nicer facility. There was a particular person down at the showgrounds named Greg Kirk, who's since passed away, who was the owner of Centennial Park Horse Hire. And he was a character because, he was a lovable rogue is how you would describe him. And he started a thing called Dawn Rides, where we used to get down there around 5:30 in the morning, get a horse and ride for about an hour and a half in the mornings before work. And these rides weren't for the faint-hearted. They weren't for people who'd just, you know, decided to take up horse riding recently. You had to be a pretty good rider because they were pretty fast and furious. And he was renowned for stepping off the horse track and going to places where you really weren't supposed to go and jumping things you really weren't supposed to jump. And so there were lots of fun. And often they would be themed. We'd have cowboys and Indians dawn rides, or we'd all go to the hunt ball on a Saturday night and end up at the bourbon and beefsteak and then come to Centennial Park in the mornings in our ball gowns and top hat and tails and stuff and go for a dawn ride. So we did a lot of that sort of crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so that was all, they were all horses that would have been stabled at the showground?
They were horses kept within that riding school.
At the showground?
At the showground, yeah.
Mm. So does that riding school still exist? No, he passed away, you said.
He passed away, but I think the name is still there and I think someone has that name and runs a riding school under that name, but he passed away possibly 10, 15 years ago, yeah.
So what was the horse that you had stabled there? Did you have more than one?
I had Casey, which is the original horse from Melbourne. I kept him there for a little while. Then I bought an Appaloosa as a one-year-old, and I kept him there for a little while and broke him in down there when he was three, which was really, really hard. Don't break a horse in if you don't have a round yard.
Is that what you need?
That's what you need. Mm-hmm. I've had some thoroughbred there. I did something called the Level 1, which is a riding instructor's certificate. So I kept a horse there. So, yeah, on and off. It's not an ideal place to keep a horse. I think it's very hard on them. I think horses kept there must get out of their box at least twice a day minimum. And, I had a horse there, but I shipped him out every weekend to a place in the country where we go, and he got to run around a paddock 2 days a week.
Do you have any horses now?
Yes, I have four horses.
And where are they?
They're at a property on the Hawkesbury River. So I have a stock horse mare, an ex-race horse, and an Anglo-Arab and a pony.
And you go to that place quite often?
Yes.
Right. So how easy is it in Sydney to, particularly in the inner suburbs, and I guess Bellevue Hill is kind of an inner suburb, to actually maintain a relationship with horses? Because this is one of the things now, isn't it, in urban life, that children often don't have much contact with animals apart from fully domesticated pets.
Yeah, well, that's sad. I mean, I have two daughters, and my eldest child got her first pony when she was 6 months old. I mean, as you do. But really, when truth be known, that was my pony, the one I wanted when I was a child, that I asked Santa Claus for every year and didn't get. So those kids have been around big mammals, and my horses are very nice horses, very well-behaved horses. In fact, I haven't paid for any of those horses. They're all given to me. So people give me their horse because they know how well I look after them, and I take their horse if I know their horse is well-mannered. It may not be the best riding horse for everyone, but it's about the manners, so that kids can walk around them and catch them and feed them, and that's important. So whenever anyone's child comes to the farm, they're okay with the horses. So, my kids are really privileged, really, that they get to hang out and do that stuff and get really filthy and fall in the creek and, you know.
And ride horses.
They're not really keen. I mean, they don't care about it that much, so I don't make them do it.
Just one more question. What happened to the Hansom Cab Company? Do you know how long it survived for?
Well, the... and sold it to a couple named Anna and I can't remember their last name. And that, I think it pretty much just self-imploded after that. It was never really a money-making concern. The problem with horses, as they say, how do you make $1 million out of horses, start with $3 million, is that they go lame and they get sick and I had a little bit to do with the company at that point when it was sold. I was sort of handed over as the manager, and I would forever be fighting for the horse, saying, look, this horse can't work. It needs 10 days off. Now, that's 10 days it's standing there eating. And after 6 months or so, these people said, well, we've got a new policy. If a horse can't work for a week, it goes to the market. It gets sold. And, you know, that was just ridiculous, because you took a horse like Frank or Joe or Gus, who'd been with the company for 4 years and were just the best reliable horses. If he went lame, he's worth rehabilitating. Even if it takes 2 months, you've got to put him out for 2 months. You don't just get rid of this like people. You don't just get rid of them because they get long in the tooth. So they didn't understand that. They were looking at it from a mathematical point of view. But You know, it's the same with all the riding schools. You know, it rains, people don't come. Horses still eat. Horses still need shoes. And they cost a lot. And, you know, I feed my horses in the winter, and it's on the basic rations, nothing fancy, but enough to keep body and soul together, it's $200 a month per horse. So...
So running a business based on horses is always going to be
It's really hard. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. So nobody gets really rich, mate, and, you know, unless you happen to have a Maccabi diva with horses.
Mm. And so presumably then the Hansom Cab Company, that sounds like its life was probably about 5 years.
Yeah, possibly 5 or 6 years. I sort of lost touch, but it basically just didn't continue much after that, I suppose, around about... Yeah, I went overseas in 85, so it certainly wasn't going by then, I'd say.
And where did they actually get the cabs themselves from?
They made them. Oh. He was pretty clever. He could do just about anything. And so he engineered them and made them, and you know, took a bit of fiddling because they had to be balanced, really well balanced, and you know, they had a lot of kilometres, and so wheels fell off, shafts snapped, and things went wrong. But he basically fixed them up again. They were a metal frame with a kind of plywood outer finish, so not your fabulous coachwork or anything like that. But they did the job. They looked good.
Yeah, they. I remember seeing them and thinking that they looked like the real thing, and which they obviously weren't. And presumably it would be not all that hard necessarily to get original Hansom cabs, but it would be quite expensive, and they wouldn't last.
Yeah, well, I reckon an original Hansom cab would cost about $30,000 today, and there's no way that you would pound it around the city like we did with these things. I mean, they're just too valuable. You just keep them as for the odd outing.
Yeah, or as a museum piece or something like that.
Mm.
Okay, anything else you want to say?
Oh, no, that was just a lot of fun. It was pretty crazy and it was a lot of fun. And I guess, you know, like it's haze and it's sad we don't have horses trotting around the streets anymore. But, you know, those horses worked really hard. But, you know, those standard breeds, that's the name of the breed that in that particular racing industry, the harness racing industry, I mean, they've got no chance. Some people buy them for riding, but they're not considered to be any good for riding, really. So probably 95% of horses that don't make it in the harness industry and aren't used for breeding end up in a can of dog food. The thoroughbred horses, the racing industry horses, they've got a better chance, a much better chance of getting out there into the you know, dressage, show jumping, riding world. But those standard breeds, they've got no chance. So it's sad for them, really.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.